It's great to see everyone here today. Hope you had a good week and good week ahead of you. If you're following along this morning, we're going to be in the book of 1 Kings, starting in the 17th chapter, first verse. One day, little Melissa went and asked her mother, "Mom, I've been thinking about us humans and I'm a bit puzzled. How did we humans first appear on the earth?" "That's a very good question, darling," her mother answered. "God made Adam and Eve, and they had children, and then their children had children, and as a result, mankind began." Later that day, Melissa asked her father the same question. "Daddy, how did we humans first appear on Earth?" "Well, that's an intelligent question, Melissa," he replied. "Millions of years ago, there were monkeys from which gradually the human race evolved." Melissa, confused by the two different answers, went back to her mother and said, "How come you told me the human race was created by God, yet Daddy said they developed from monkeys?" "Well, darling," replies the mother, "the answer is simple. I told you about my side of the family, and he told you about his side of the family." You know, it's important to keep things real in perspective with God. And, you know, God is that way when he teaches us, is that he will let us know what he wants. So, before we get too far, let's read our verses here. We'll go from 17:1 through 24. "Now Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead, said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word.' And the word of the Lord came to him, 'Depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook of Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there.' So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Cherith, that is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening. And he drank from the brook. And after a while the brook dried up, because there was no rain in the land." Verse 8. "Then the word of the Lord came to him, 'Arise, go to Naphtali, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you.' So he arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there, gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, 'Bring me a little water in a vessel, that I may drink.' And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, 'Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand.' And she said, 'As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar, and a little oil in a jug. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die.' And Elijah said to her, 'Do not fear. Go and do as you have said. But first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty, until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth.' And she went and did as Elijah said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke to Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, 'What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin into remembrance and to cause the death of my son.' And he said to her, 'Give me your son.' And he took him from her arms and carried him up to the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, 'O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourned by killing her son?' Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, 'O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again.' And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came to him, and he was revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, 'See, your son lives.' And the woman said to Elijah, 'Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth.'" So, God's ways are oft times unknown to us or seem strange to us. We don't always understand what he does and why he does it or anything like that. Elijah 55, verses 8 through 9 declares, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord." And that's kind of a problem with the world. They don't understand what God is, and they believe in things like evolution and things that aren't here. The more you read about December 21st of this year and all the panic that some people are in, even around the world are engaged in, it's incredulous to me that here we have the Bible, which has so much more weight to it than any of these doomsday apocalyptic type things that are out there, and yet people are more willing to believe those kind of things. Yeah, and to go on in Isaiah 55, 8 through 9, "For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." We'll never sound the depth of the wisdom of God, his knowledge, what he knows. And we'll spend eternity trying to plumb those depths and still not understand everything. Now, man is a great thinker. The world's libraries attest to it, but God's ways are beyond all human understanding. If we had God figured out, he wouldn't be God anymore. God's much more than we can ever put a rule to and measure, put a scale to and weigh, or anything like that. If we had God figured out, we would not have to live by faith. So God can use unlikely sources to humble us in our lives, and that's basically in verses 1 through 7 of which we read. Unlike our weather prognosticators or weathermen, Elijah absolutely declared that what the weather would be, and furthermore, he declared he would determine when that weather would change. It might be hard to stay humble if you had just informed the king that it wasn't going to rain for 3 years and then only when I said it would. But Elijah knew where that source came from. And the source of that supply was God. He said the ravens would feed thee. You know, from a human standpoint, ravens would certainly not be the most likely or appealing creature to bring one food. They're scavengers, considered unclean in the law of Moses, which meant you couldn't eat them. A raven had a passion for picking out the eyes of animals. It loves to maul the sick and dying. It swallows with a vulture's gulp everything it can put its beak on, and yet for all the food Elijah gets for months, it's from these ravens. So they didn't eat the food, but they brought it to him. Ravens are rather good robbers than they are caterers. Yet, they forgot their own hunger to feed the prophet. Now, every day, Elijah realized the great miracle in that these crude beasts would not eat what they brought to him, but would bring him the food and sustenance that he needed. Now, whoever heard of such instruments being employed, birds of prey bringing food in time of famine? It would be the other way around normally. Could the ravens be depended on? Was it not far more likely that they would devour the food themselves and bring it to the prophet? Elijah's trust was not in the birds, but the sure words of God, who said it would be so. So, God's ways are not man's ways, and he proves himself in so many ways that I think people who turn their backs on God just don't understand. God could have sent an angel to minister to him, but he chose another messenger, another one that to bring the food. And in that, proved his power over nature to effectively do what he wanted to do, and that was feed Elijah. So, human thinking would say that's silly. That doesn't make sense. God does this often to keep our eyes on him as the primary source in our life. And many times when we needed things, a lot of times came from unlikely sources in our life. People who we thought maybe didn't like us or didn't want to have anything to do with us reached out with the hand of help in certain times. So, God is always showing us that he can meet our needs. And it's not going to be obvious. It's not going to be Meals on Wheels falling out of the sky to feed us, but other ways and other means that prove His power. God can use unlikely strategies to help us, as in verse 8 through 16. After a while, the brook dries up. God gives him a kind of a strange command. He says, go to this city, and you'll find a widow woman who will sustain you. Now, widows are not rich people, especially in that day and age. See, she didn't inherit any big insurance policy back then that put her on easy street for the rest of her days. She eked out a living. And in fact, when Elijah goes there, she says, you know, I barely got enough for us, and we're about half dead, so we're going to eat this and then probably die because there's nothing else. To go to an unlikely place, too. Go to Zarah, the very place from which Jezebel had come from. So this wasn't the best of places or the most generous of places to send Elijah. How strange are the ways of God when we read this. You know, people would call this suicidal for, you know, him to go back there. God providing for his prophets first by an unclean bird and then by a Gentile, whom the Jews called unclean, is unlikely to man's thinking. You think God was trying to kind of enlighten them that even though they were unclean, they still served a purpose in God's kingdom? Just because the Jews were the vessel through which Christ came, that didn't mean that God didn't look upon the rest of the world and act upon it. So God's ways are not our ways. Don't look for him in the usual manner sometimes. And an unlikely person, again, the widow. This was not a rich person, and this was someone who probably lived on the margins of society. And she felt that we're going to eat this last meal, and that's it. And we're going to probably die. So God's commands don't always appeal to our intellect, though in fact, they're the most logical things to do because they're God's commands. We're not asked to understand God's commands, we're only asked to obey them. And that's really what faith is all about. That's really what baptism is about. We can look at it, and Paul admitted it, it's not going to make you clean, it's not going to make you all shiny and new, it's not going to make up for all the sins we committed in our lives, but it's an act of obedience that whatever God tells us to do, then we're going to do it, even if it, you know, doesn't make sense to us. We're going to obey God. You know, over and over again, it was an unlikely strategy for Nahum to dip 7 times in Jordan River. What did that do besides wet him 7 times? It was an unlikely strategy for Gideon to use pitchers and trumpets to defeat the Midianites, but it sure proved who was in control and who had the power. It was an unlikely strategy for Joshua to defeat Jericho by marching around the walls. Faith is trusting that God knows best, even when his strategy seems unlikely, because that's God proving to us that he's there and in control. When something unlikely happens to straighten out our lives, God's showing his power. You know, we can all, you know, if we cut ourselves, get some bacitracin or something like that and get rid of the infection and take, you know, put a Band-Aid on it and make it better. That's logical. But when God acts in strange ways to make things right, he shows that to us, the faithful. Now, the unfaithful, they're not going to get lucky, happenstance, coincidence, whatever. They're not going to get what God's trying to tell them. But they should, unfortunately. God can use unlikely situations to honor. In verses 17 through 24, with the miracle of the multiplying mean, the flour and the oil continued daily, Elijah and the widow and their son were getting along wonderfully despite the famine that raged all around them. Then one day their tranquility was abruptly interrupted, and the widow woman, her son, died. A heavy trial has now come upon the scene, with her facing the loss of her son, and Elijah facing, you know, the idea that why would God do this at this time? So they were walking in obedient lives. They were doing what God wanted them to. Both had been tested severely about obeying the Lord, and they passed all those tests. Yet in spite of their noble obedience, they now experience the loss with the death of her son. That great trial. And the perplexity in the trial. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 12, though the trial may seem strange to us, it is not strange to God. He knows what He is doing. God has a reason for every trial, and there are always good reasons. Now, we know some trials come upon us because we're sinful in life, and we need to make a change, and God is helping calling our attention to that. Some trials come upon us because it's just the world, and we're separated from God by that, you know, great gulf of sin. You know, that Jesus makes possible for us to have a relationship with Him, but not a full relationship until we leave this sinful world here. So, but in all these trials, whether they're deserved or just happenstance or just, you know, something that happens as life goes on, they're all fruitful in that they can strengthen us and that we can use them to straighten out our lives and to come closer to God. So many blessings can only come through trials. In verse 24, the trial proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that Elijah was a man of God. See, she still had a little doubt in there. Trials are not a waste, they are not a loss, they are not a mistake. They produce some of the greatest blessings man can ever possess. Now, granted, I'm like you. If I'm going through a trial, it is no fun. It's nothing we want to go through. It can be horrible, it can be distressing, it can weigh on us heavily, as nothing else has weighed on us in our lives. But when we got through it and saw the hand of God and the things that went on and how we got through it, we come out stronger, because through it all, like a sturdy chain, even though it was pulled hard, it withstood all of that and remained strong. And we remain strong in God and trust Him even more as time goes on. It gives us the opportunity to be a testimony for Jesus Christ in a very forceful, clear, and unmistakable way. That no matter what we're going through in life, that people around us see that we still have faith in God, we still have trust in God, and we know that in the end, God is going to take care of us. Sometimes the problems and trials come in our lives so God can honor us. How to cross the swollen Jordan River was a problem for Joshua, but the Lord used it to elevate Joshua in the sight of the people in Joshua 4:14. It shows a way for him to prove that God is with him. And that's how we prove each and every day that God is with us. Now, we truly trust Him. We don't pay Him lip service. Notice, oh yeah, I believe in God. You know, we've talked about James before. We've talked about works versus grace and all that. We're studying Romans this morning, and with Paul, you know, emphasizing the grace part of it. Like, you know, it made me think, always use the thermometer, as, you know, like works. In other words, it's an indication of that. But that thermometer alone does not make the heat that it records. That gas gauge in your car, it doesn't have gas in it. It just shows us the amount that's elsewhere. They're indicators. And an indication of a life that's faithful to God is that when trials come upon him, just like Job, it was easy to praise God when things were going good. And that was the devil's complaint. It's easy to praise God when things are good, but when you're going through the trials of your life, when you're going through the pits and the depths of despair and all that, but each and every day you turn to God in prayer and you pray and you study and you meditate on His Word, you show the world and you show the devil just whom do you trust and who you trust and know is going to get you through those trials. So someday we can live in a place where there's no trials anymore. In Daniel 3, verses 26 through 30, God used the fiery furnace to elevate the three Hebrew children. He showed that these were His and He was going to protect them. Problems, pressures, persecutions may be situations God uses to honor and bless us in this life. It's hard to think of a trial coming upon us as something that honors us. But it's through these, our integrity through these trials, and our stick-fastness to God, so to speak, that's going to prove to scoffers out there who controls our life and who we trust to make it through this life. So God's ways may seem strange to us, but may we always remember that we can trust Him. He's definitely the God of unlikely scenarios and situations, and He uses those unusual ways not only to find His people, people that are going to have faith in Him no matter what, but also to prove to us and those around us that God's ways are not man's ways, and His glory and His people are going to be manifest in those things. I don't know what your condition is this morning, but there's no better place to be than on the other shore with Jesus. There's no better place to be than with God. And if you need to come to the other shore, we can help you get there. And if you need to come back to the right shore, we can help you get there. Whatever your needs may be this morning, won't you come as we stand and sing song invitations?